Get ready for a messy divorce today on The World. The British voters have spoken. A majority of them want their country to leave the European Union. In Brussels, it feels like a marriage on the rocks.
You're having problems with your spouse, and then you wake up to divorce papers. The British people clearly are not happy with their membership.
And that means some tough mediation sessions.
After the divorce, you need a settlement. And the settlement is where the terms of trade will come in with the EU.
Even this pro-leave politician admits confusing times are ahead.
I suppose uncertainty is the word that best describes how a lot of people here in the UK are feeling. So there is a real job of work to be done to get those people to feel confident that the UK can make it on its own.
Those stories today on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. When you turn the page and land on a chapter without a title, it's hard to say what's coming next. Welcome to Brexit World, a place where we're really not sure what is going to happen next. For the next hour on The World, we're going to look at how Brexit may change life in the UK, in Europe, in a lot of places. One photo today on Twitter captures it, a table laden with fine European food on one side, on the other, a solitary can of baked beans, the classic English favorite. In other words, with Brexit, Brits are closing their doors on the continent and embracing the old ways of the United Kingdom. James Cleverly is a Conservative MP in the UK. He was one of the prominent campaigners to leave the EU.
I think that most people were expecting it was going to be a tight result. And to be honest with you, I think the majority of people also thought that it was going to be a Remain vote. So the fact it was tight was not a surprise, but I do think there was a bit of a shock that the country did vote to leave the EU. I suppose uncertainty is the word that best describes how a lot of people here in the UK are feeling.
Hearing you speak, I think it's kind of remarkable that someone who supported the Brexit is, you feel kind of, it sounds like you're on the fence still. Why did you do this? Why did you support the vote?
No, I'm absolutely not on the fence. I am confident that the UK's best future is outside the EU. The European Union is a very slow-moving beast. It's inflexible. We try to renegotiate our relationship, those renegotiations got nowhere. It is not ready for the 21st century world in which we live. So I'm completely confident the country made the right decision. But deep down, all of us, all humans, are a bit nervous about change, the British particularly so. And we have embarked on a really exciting but very, very significant change.
What we've seen with Brexit has been kind of a tale of two Britons. You represent people in Essex, which has been one of the most Eurosceptic areas of the country. 61% of your constituency voted for leaving. How did this huge division emerge in Britain?
I think that is the most important question that we take out from this. If you look at the picture of who voted for Remain and who voted for Leave, there is a very distinct split in the UK. The most obvious one is the split between Scotland and the rest of the UK. But you also see that in London, there was a strong Remain vote, but pretty much everywhere else, including some, you know, traditional industrial areas of the UK, what you in the States might call the Rust Belt. Those voters are really uncomfortable with the direction of travel, particularly of the EU. I think they're disillusioned with politicians as a whole, not just European politicians, and they want to see a really big change. I think we need to respond to that. Because if any of us think that leaving the EU will make their concerns vanish, I think we're fooling ourselves.
You know, there's been some criticism, a lot of criticism of the way immigration featured in the referendum debate, kind of central to a lot of the press coverage. And we had that famous UKIP poster, which showed refugees in Slovenia with the words breaking point superimposed over the image. Your own mother emigrated from Sierra Leone to the UK. How have you felt about the way immigration has been discussed in the whole Brexit referendum?
I felt very uncomfortable. I'll be completely straight with you. I felt very uncomfortable with that poster. I think that there has been a demonization amongst some people in the British political scene of refugees and migrants, which I think is deeply, deeply unpalatable. But those ideas have been given oxygen because a lot of people feel that the British immigration system isn't working. One of the byproducts of our membership of the EU is that we have to accept completely free movement of any EU citizen. So to put that into perspective, it's like the USA having a completely open border with any country in Latin America and having absolutely no say who comes. And that's something that I'm sure Americans wouldn't be comfortable with. And that's the kind of thing that does need to be addressed so we can reduce some of the tension about immigration.
What will you miss about the EU relationship with the UK?
I don't think I'll miss very much about the EU relationship. There are plenty of things that I love about Europe.
Like what?
Well, you know, we have a huge amount of cultural diversity in a very small space. What I won't miss is that heavy hand of bureaucracy, the massive overregulation, the stifling of innovation, and the stifling of business creativity. Those are the things I won't miss at all.
James Cleverly there, a Conservative MP who supported the Leave campaign in the UK. As we just said, one of the reasons cited for leaving is the desire to control immigration. Ever since Poland joined the EU in 2004, there's been this image in the UK of the Polish plumber descending on the British Isles to take jobs. There are hundreds of thousands of Poles living in the UK now, and they're wondering what the Brexit vote is going to mean for them. Rok Dunin-Wasiewicz is researcher at the London School of Economics. He's also Polish, and he's done a lot of research on Polish workers in Britain.
And a lot of these people are afraid of what Brexit might bring.
And what are they afraid of specifically?
Well, there are a few questions to be answered. Those of the people who've lived here for more than 5 years, they automatically acquire a right to residency under British law. So they're no longer treated as mobile citizens of the European Union, but their rights to reside here and work are based on their tenure here. However, around half of the people, of the Polish people living here, have been here shorter than those 5 years, and their status is very uncertain.
Yeah, and is there any sense among the Poles that you've spoken with in the UK that racism, that discrimination might increase as the Brexit is formalized?
I think xenophobia was one of the features of this campaign, unfortunately. And this is something that's been developing throughout the years. And I must admit that it's also, you know, the fault lies also with the government that started talking about benefit scroungers and people abusing the welfare system who come from the rest of the European Union. Most of the studies have shown that if there are any instances of that, they're highly negligible. But they were made into that scapegoat. And people are feeling that they are becoming the other in this country, especially since most of them are white and Christian, and people feel like that they are not a protected category.
What's it like for a Polish academic in the UK?
I am quite privileged, and I personally have not experienced anything except some mild condescension. But, you know, I have been given all the opportunities by this country that I could only imagine. I am just afraid of what kind of repercussions this vote and whatever results it may bring will have on the people who have not been as fortunate as me.
Yeah, but are you concerned that mild condescension could grow into something more more toxic?
That is always the possibility, and that's why the result of this vote and this campaign has been so detrimental to social cohesion in this country.
Ultimately, Rok, did Brexit make you want to leave England? And if it does, where would you go?
Well, Brexit hasn't actually happened yet. And how it will all unfold, it is yet to be determined. I have the privilege of being a resident in this country, so I have nothing to fear. I'm also have the privilege of being a Polish citizen, a European citizen, so I can live and work in all of the 27 countries of the other 27 countries of the European Union. And, you know, in my time, I have studied and lived in New York in the United States. So that's always an option. But for now, I'm staying.
Rok Dunin-Wasiewicz is Polish and he's a researcher at the London School of Economics. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
The World's Mary Kay Magzat joins me now. She was our longtime China correspondent, now host of the podcast, Whose Century Is It? Mary Kay, your next podcast is actually all about the pressure squeezing the middle class here in the U.S., but we could just as well point to places like Britain, too, I suppose. What is your reaction to the Brexit news today and the forces that led to it?
Yeah, well, stunned like so many people. But one of the things that I started thinking about immediately, given that I'm in the midst of this podcast, is that in Britain, as here in the United States, the middle class and the working class have found in recent years that the cost of living is rising faster than wages, and that they have to go into debt to maintain the standard of living they've had. Many people have to. Government services and subsidies have shrunk. Companies are holding cash and focused on short-term profits. So this is a big change from the post-World War II era. And so even though unemployment levels are not so high, debt is higher and insecurity, feeling of insecurity is higher. And so the understandable reaction is to look for someone to blame. Mm-hmm. The Britain First crowd has been saying, blame the immigrants, blame the EU. And if you don't think too hard about it, that seems reasonable. I mean, you can make the argument of, hey, we're British. There was a time when the sun never set on our empire. If we can just get back to being British, just British, we'd be better off. But if you think about it rationally, there are lots of indicators why that's not true.
So, Mary Kay, I know you lived in Britain as a graduate student in the 1980s and after. What were attitudes like towards Europe then, especially on the things you were just talking about, the economy and immigration?
Yeah, well, so I got to Britain in 1984 in the middle of the coal miners' strike. Margaret Thatcher was promoting privatization, deregulation. And a lot of people, particularly the working class, but also the middle class, had a sort of a sense of betrayal. This was also a time when there were riots in Tottenham, where I lived, and in Brixton. Some of that was related to immigration, too. There's this feeling of there are these other people who are coming into Britain and who are taking away the very little that we have. And, I was there when the debates were going on. Within the Conservative Party, the very people who were pushing deregulation and privatization and creating this sense of instability and insecurity for the working class and the middle class, but they were also very wary of joining the EU.
So this UK narrative that's led to Brexit, you see parallels with other places you've covered?
Yeah, well, so I think that the whole experience for Britain of going from being this extraordinary imperial power that controlled, sort of a third of the world at one point, to being another European country with, an economy that was just kind of so-so. I mean, there was a special relationship with the U.S., and there still is, but that wasn't quite the same thing. When I lived in China, there was also, and there is also, this narrative of national humiliation. We aren't what we were. We aren't what we should be. We aren't what we could be. There are other things getting in the way. There are outsiders getting in our way. We need to get back to what we were. But I'll say something else. I also lived in Southeast Asia. I covered the Southeast Asian region for 7 years, just after I lived in Britain, late 80s, early 90s. And at that time, Southeast Asia was embracing the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which at that point was kind of a political talking shop. But just now, in the last year, they've started the Association of Southeast Asian Economic Community, and I actually did a podcast specifically on this recently, moving closer toward the EU model, but stopping short of giving up quite as much autonomy, quite as much sovereignty. There's a recognition in Southeast Asia that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, that by working together, Southeast Asians can counterbalance their big neighbors in China and in India and find new and interesting ways to work with them. But also that by working together, they're not fighting each other.
That narrative that you saw kind of mirrored from the UK and China, we used to be great and we will be great again. I mean, similar narratives in Russia and also here in the US and a lot of places. What strikes you most about the outcome of this vote as you take in this news today, Mary Kay?
The lives of people in Britain and their prospects have changed quite a bit in the post-World War II era in general and since the 2008 financial crisis in particular. And unless people have a clear idea of what is and isn't causing the changes that they're experiencing, it's easy to blame outsiders. It's easy to buy into a populist campaign, whether it's make Britain great again or make America great again or make Russia great again. But then once you bought into that campaign and you've got a vote like this, you also have to live with the consequences of having bought into it. And now we're going to see what those consequences will be.
Mary Kay Magstad is the host of our podcast, Whose Century Is It? Great to speak with you, Mary Kay. Thank you.
Great speaking with you too, Marco. Thanks.
You can subscribe to Mary Kay's podcast on iTunes. Just look for Whose Century Is It? And we'll be digging deeper into the Brexit vote. It's all coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's stay on the Brexit victory. Britain's vote to get out of the European Union has a lot of people worried and also really confused. Nothing's actually happened yet, but a UK departure could have a real impact on global trade and the world economy. The World's Jason Margolis has more on that.
Think of the EU as a club with economic benefits. Michelle Egan, a fellow with the Global Europe Program at the Wilson Center in Washington, explains the idea of a single market.
Well, a single market is something we don't even think about in the United States, but a single market allows us not to sort of have to pay extra tariffs or customs duties. It means that we can trade across borders, trade across markets, and have ease of currency transactions. So it allows us also as consumers to have more choice.
Other benefits being in the EU club? Labor mobility.
If people are looking for work, they can move across borders and they don't have complicated visa requirements. If you're a doctor trained in Germany, you have the opportunity to practice in another European country.
Good for that doctor who wants to relocate, but a lot of Brits felt this free movement of labor was also taking away UK jobs. And so now Britain could soon begin a 2-year withdrawal process from the EU.
If you like, think about it first as a divorce. And then after the divorce, you need a settlement. And the settlement is where the terms of trade will come in with the EU.
And what would that look like? That's an open question, says Egan, who is from Northern England. Would Brits pay tariffs to sell products in Europe? And how would the UK negotiate new trade deals?
With over 50 countries that the EU currently has.
That won't be easy, says Robert Kahn, a senior fellow for international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations.
You know, these agreements are achieved through a complex set of horse trading. And in each of these cases, it's quite possible that the efforts to try and recreate, raise up objections, vested interests and the like in ways that make negotiating these agreements actually pretty challenging. Doesn't mean it can't be done.
But it could be a difficult road. That's what's facing the UK today. What about the EU? It's losing one of its economic pillars. Domenico Lombardi, an Italian economist with the Canadian think tank CIGI, says EU leaders could make things difficult for the UK to send a message.
Well, you're not a member of the club because you voted to leave the club.
EU leaders are concerned about other countries flirting with the idea of leaving the club, countries like France and the Netherlands. So that's what's going on in Europe. What about the U.S. and our trading relationship? Is the stuff we buy from the U.K. going to cost more? Again, Robert Kahn.
No, well, I think in the near term it's going to cost less. We saw a pretty dramatic move in the pound.
The pound fell to a 30-year low overnight. And Kahn says the Brexit vote could very well weaken the euro, too.
It probably means European goods will be cheaper. Europe will be a cheaper place to take a vacation.
But there's always a trade-off. A strong dollar means that U.S. exports could become less competitive, and that could hurt the U.S. economy. Some economists are warning of an increased chance of another worldwide recession. Hard to know what's going to happen, says Domenico Lombardi.
Because this is a unique situation, there is no real precedent for this. It's really impossible to make a fair prediction because the past is not of any guide.
Like the rest of us, economists are watching as history is being made. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Let's go now to France and check in with our correspondent, Adeline Sia. Adele, the whole world woke up and could not believe the result. What is the general reaction in France? How are the French taking this Brexit news?
It feels like the shocking end of a beautiful friendship. So it's a very emotional response here. And I was surprised, actually, because people seem to be very pained and even panicked by this decision. I think including President François Hollande, who said it's a painful decision and he regrets it profoundly for the UK and for Europe.
Where does most of the regret come from? Why are people regretting the UK leaving the EU?
It just feels like maybe there should have been some talks ahead of this. It feels very abrupt. I don't think, again, no one really expected they would go this direction. Certainly Europe had to make some progress. A lot of people were, you know, there was a lot of discontent with bureaucracy in Brussels and everything, but not something that could not be worked out. And now they just basically walked out on us. And I think people just feel abandoned by this very powerful country. And it is worrisome.
I don't want to say the Brexit vote will spark a domino effect, but far-right parties in France and the Netherlands are already calling for their own get-out-of-the-EU referendum. Let's hear Marine Le Pen, who's the leader of the far-right National Front Party in France.
Pour tous les patriotes, pour tous les amoureux de la liberté, ce jour est donc un jour de joie.
Adele, what's Marine Le Pen saying there?
Well, she's saying, for all the patriots, for all those who love freedom, this day is one of joy. It's not Europe which has died. It's the European Union which is shaking, and it is a rebirth of the nations, and they need to build between them a new European project, that of cooperation. And that's a little strange to me, because I thought that's what we had. I thought we had cooperation. So basically she's saying it's great, we get to start from scratch. And she called for a referendum here in France as soon as possible. And the vice president of the Front National, the far-right party, Florent Philippot, said the same thing. He said he was glad to see people taking their destiny into their own hands. And again, I thought we had done that when we had a European project of a united Europe.
You grew up in France with the UK in the EU, Adele. How do you feel about the Brexit outcome?
It's really a heartbreak. You know, I mean, I was up all night listening to the BBC. I just couldn't believe it. I grew up here with this idea of being a European citizen as a given. And I count on it. I count on staying European. I like to be free to move about and to make sure that I can cross borders without having to go into any kind of extended customs. You know, you just... You basically don't realize it when you cross the borders, when you're on a train going from Paris to the Netherlands. You know, it's only the charm of your cell phone telling you you have changed network. That's the only thing that tells you you've moved from another country to the other. So it's very sad. I'm worried about this sense of solidarity vanishing. I just feel like we're regressing. Europe is regressing. And I'm very concerned about that. And I see that as an erosion of those freedoms that we've really taken for granted all these years. And it's really sad. The idea is to make progress and have more solidarity, not less. So I just feel like we're not going in the right direction here. And shortbread cookies might become very expensive.
British shortbread. That is a concern. It is a concern. Adeline Sia in Burgundy in France. Thank you, Adele.
You're welcome, Marco.
Coming up, how practically does Britain get out of the EU? We'll find out later on the show. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Alistair G is a Brit living in San Francisco. He was really hoping Britain would choose to stay in the EU. And when the Leave camp won the vote, he could only think of his family back home.
Whatever it was like for me watching the news unfold in slow motion, I think for them it felt like a punch to the stomach.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A week ago, when I spoke with Alistair G, the idea that the British would opt to leave the European Union seemed pretty unlikely. G is a British journalist and writer living in California, and he said he was voting to stay. His brother was casting a proxy vote for him in London.
I think almost everybody in my family voted to remain, and they can't quite comprehend that it's happened.
Now, with yesterday's vote, it looks like Britain is closing the door on the EU and all that that means. And a lot of people are scared.
I was speaking with my brother today, and he works in finance in London, and he said he went for a haircut at lunchtime, and his Italian barber, who owns the salon, was distraught and didn't know whether he could stay in the country. One of the most striking things about this referendum has been that a large majority of young people voted to remain. And so I joked to my brother that now maybe we should have a Yexit. And he said, people are feeling quite regretful. They want to have a Regrexit.
And a Regrexit. When the pundits called the vote early this morning, it was what, about 8 p.m. in California? What was the night like for you?
Well, San Francisco is about 8 hours behind London. So when I woke up yesterday morning, voting was already in full swing, and I followed it through to the very end. And the first result came from the British territory of Gibraltar on the tip of Spain, and it was 96% to stay in the EU. At that point, I was feeling quite buoyant. Then some of the next results were for cities in the northeast of England, Sunderland and Newcastle, that were a lot more in favor of leaving than they had been thought to be. And the pundits I was following online started to sound nervous. At that point, I got a sick feeling in my stomach that lasted until the end of the day, when my friends and family started waking up in the UK. And whatever it was like for me watching the news unfold in slow motion, I think for them, it felt like a punch to the stomach.
You mentioned, Alistair, how the vote kind of split along generational lines, the young people, millennials wanting to remain in the EU, older people of a different generation leaving. What about your own family? I mean, was there that generational difference?
My mom is hoping that things will turn out for the best. She was on the fence. My brother managed to convince her to vote to remain in the EU. And there's been a little bit of chat on our family's WhatsApp group this morning. And essentially she's saying, well, maybe, I hope, it won't be as bad as you think it will be.
What do you think? You think she's right?
Well, I think I'm afraid for the country of how it's going to weather the upheavals that are likely to come, the threats to its economy, the shakeup of its political structure, and who knows what will happen with Scotland. In a broader sense, I'm grappling with the defeat of some ideals that I believed in: internationalism, inclusiveness, togetherness. They symbolize the European project for me. And in a sense, I might even say that this referendum for me is like the loss of a dream. Of course, it's not dead forever, but the UK said no to it yesterday, at least.
Does it make you think twice about whether you might go back to England one day?
Well, I feel deeply disappointed in the UK and deeply sorry for it. But the decision has been made, and as hard as it is, we have to step into, or as hard as it is, Britain has to step into that future now and live in it. So I don't have any thought of abandoning the UK, though at the moment, I also feel very distant from it.
I'm sure you've been explaining to Americans where you are in San Francisco, the whole vote and its significance leading up to yesterday. But what about the result now? How are you explaining what Brexit now means for the future for the UK? And are you drawing on any parallels with what's happening here in the US right now?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, all of my friends get it, and there's been a lot of disappointment that I've seen, and they and I as well are also frightened about the parallels with what's happening here in the US, and it's
specifically what do you kind of land on when you draw those parallels out?
I'm thinking about the Trumpist movement and the appeal of nationalism, the sense that perhaps we are better looking inwards than outwards. And I hope people see that that has an allure to some folks, and that allure, I think, is deceptive, and we need to be really forceful in countering it and showing people that there is a better way forward.
So how long do you think this cloud of Brexit will remain above your head? And it's kind of tough so far from the UK.
Well, I think what's difficult to deal with is that this is a decision that will unfold over the course of decades. It's not an election where in 4 years we'll just have another go at it, at choosing again. It seems like this referendum will have an astonishing profundity and finality. So for myself and for Britain, I hope that this gloom lifts sooner rather than later.
British journalist Alistair Gee speaking with me from San Francisco. He's a regular contributor to The New Yorker. Alistair, thank you.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Alistair mentioned there the allure of turning inward. It's not just in Britain. Already the UK's vote to leave has far-right parties in other EU countries demanding their own referendums in France, in the Netherlands, in Denmark. Some are describing it as a last call for a European Union. Tyra Palmieri is a Brussels-based political reporter for Politico. So Brussels is the heart of the European Union. What's the mood there right now?
It's actually really depressing right now. A lot of people are in shock. They can't believe it. I mean, you have to understand that the people that work in Brussels are believers in the EU project. I think my only analogy would be, you know, you're having problems with your spouse and then you wake up to divorce papers. And I think everybody was sort of in denial for the past year. But the British people clearly are not happy with their membership in the EU. So that means the EU needs to change if it wants to keep the rest of the club together.
So for those true believers of the EU project in Brussels, mm-hmm. are they today kind of trying to imagine what the EU will look like without the UK?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to be an issue just because their economy is very intertwined with other EU countries like Belgium, Ireland. It does $1.2 billion in trade every week with Ireland alone. That's more than China and India combined. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they are in the largest single market in the world and they can trade free trade without tariffs. So now once you leave that club, you no longer have access to that market unless you set up a special trade deal. So it might not be the most favorable term for the UK if they want to try to get some good trade deals with the EU now that they're just one country versus 27 others. in 2 years when they are officially outside of the EU, they will be a third country. It'll be like the same as trading with China.
Meantime, the EU has to go about its own business with its EU members. How disruptive is Brexit to just EU governance?
Well, it's extremely disruptive because for the past year, they've basically put everything on hold, trying not to upset the Eurosceptics in the UK who are likely to vote for Leave. And that includes, you know, passing their 7-year budget. I mean, they had a midterm review and they needed $20 billion more dollars to deal with the refugee crisis. And instead of dealing with that head on for the past 6 months, they decided to put that off because they didn't want the headlines from $20 billion added to the EU budget to upset people who already think the place is too bloated. And a lot of other like initiatives that are kind of frowned on in the UK that they just haven't been working on. People say it's been in a stalemate ever since the referendum. So now it's time to get it back together and also decide, like, is it worth it to pursue these projects, which are so unpopular in Eurosceptic countries? I mean, is this just an economic union or is it a political union? Is it more Europe that's the answer or is it less Europe? These are the questions that the leaders here are trying to grapple with, because there are a lot of true believers in this federal project, especially those that saw their parents fighting against each other in World War II and World War I. So, you know, there's a lot of sentimental reason, too, to keep this together. It's not just about money.
The same kind of forces that were pushing for the Brexit are now pushing for an exit in places like the Netherlands and France. What's the fear of a domino effect now?
Like you said, probably the biggest sensitivity right now is France, because it is one of the founding members. And according to this EU barometer poll that was revealed last week, the French actually are more Eurosceptic than the Brits, which is insane.
Wow.
Like, yeah, so their happiness with the EU is even lower. So just imagine that. I mean, this is a very fragile house of cards right now. And then you have the Netherlands, where they just had a referendum on a trade deal with Ukraine and the EU, and they voted against it. And a lot of people just saw that referendum as not so much a referendum on the trade deal, but more on a referendum of the EU and their happiness with it. So clearly, people are not happy with the status quo. They don't think the people that they elected to represent them in the EU, their members of parliament, that they are doing the job that they elected them to do.
Final question. What do you think Brussels should say to all these countries so that this running for the exits doesn't happen?
I'm not a political consultant, but I hear the complaints on both sides, and I really do think that Brussels needs to evaluate this idea of a political union. 27 countries, I mean, it's too much of a difference. I mean, Portugal and Poland, they're two very different countries with two very different political situations. And if you tell these people, you know, you have to vote the same way, you have to agree with all the same rules, it's just very difficult. And I think they may have pushed it too far. I think they really tried for this federalist super state, the United States of Europe. And this is what happened, the backlash.
Tara Palmieri with Politico in Brussels. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
So what happens now after the Brexit vote? Technically, the UK hasn't left the EU, not yet. The current Prime Minister, David Cameron, plans to leave that up to the next Prime Minister after he steps down in the fall. Bloomberg reporter Ian Wishart says to actually secede, the UK has to invoke something called Article 50 of the EU Treaty.
Once it happens, once that Article 50 is triggered, there's then 2 years for Britain to negotiate with the rest of the EU to work out what kind of deal it wants after it leaves. So it's still a long way to go.
Now, I've heard that the process of getting out of the EU could take as long as 10 years. Why would that be?
Simply because everything is so complicated. You know, these EU laws have been built up since the 1950s, and slowly but surely, many, many aspects of legislation in the UK has been replaced by EU law. And not only EU law, but also every trading agreement. So all of those would have to be replaced by UK trade deals. So these sorts of things take such a long time.
I mean, how testy will those negotiations be? Will the EU just look at negotiators from the UK, whoever they may be, and say, why should we make an effort to be nice to you after you told us to sod off?
Well, there are two schools of thought, really. I mean, there is one bloc within the EU, probably led by the French, maybe the Spanish and the Italians, who basically say that. They say, well, you know, you've said you don't want to be part of us. Why should we give you any favorable treatment? More than anything else, because we don't want to encourage anybody else to do the same. We don't want to give them any signal that you can do this and get away with it and have a nice time afterwards.
Mm.
On the other hand, there are some other countries, such as Germany, perhaps, a bit more pragmatic, who think, well, you know, we want to carry on trading with the British. It's not in our interest either to make life difficult for them.
So UK residents living now in the EU and vice versa, Europeans living in the UK, they're not getting kicked out today, obviously. But what's going to happen down the road to the free movement of people?
Again, it all depends on what sort of deal can be cut. The pro-Brexit camp in the run-up to this referendum were saying, if you're already there, we're not going to kick you out. And that would probably be the case vice versa for British citizens like me, for example, living in Belgium or living in other countries of the EU. But, you know, it's all up in the air. Nobody has any idea really what this is going to look like in a couple of years' time.
You sketched out for Bloomberg a couple of different ways how the relationship between the UK and the EU might look down the road. What are the scenarios that you're looking at?
There are kind of three main options, really. There's the model like Norway. Norway has complete access to the single market of the EU. There's free movement of workers. They can come and go and work in Norway. It also contributes to the EU budget, but because it's not in the EU, it doesn't have any say in the way the EU operates. So that would be a very strange model to have, considering people didn't like the EU in the first place. Mm. The middle road would be to have some kind of free trade agreement like Canada is just about to get with the EU. So they would have to work out exactly where there would be access to the EU market and that kind of thing. And then the sort of more extreme version would be complete breakaway, any trading arrangement between Britain and the EU just done under a sort of World Trade Organization rules. That would make Britain no different from Russia or Brazil. So that would be the real extreme option.
Let's talk about leadership briefly. David Cameron originated the Brexit vote, and as you said, he'll probably resign by October. Remind us why he pretty much has to go.
Well, he kind of staked his leadership on this. He said, I'm going to try to get some EU reforms, and he did get some. And after getting them, he said, you know, please back me. I want the UK to stay in the EU. The fact that he lost it means people are beginning to doubt why he should be there. And it seems to me that Britain has never been more divided. There's, you know, a real split between those who wanted to leave and those who didn't. So there are massive divisions. So these are going to resonate across British politics for a long time.
Bloomberg's Ian Wishart in Brussels, thank you very much for joining us after what must have been a very, very long night for you.
Thank you very much.
You often hear about the special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. President Obama said today that it would endure even after the British vote to quit the EU. Hillary Clinton also spoke of a, quote, steadfast commitment to that special relationship. In a moment, we'll hear about Donald Trump's perspective on the Brexit vote. But first, Ivo Dalder was Obama's ambassador to NATO. He's now the president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And he points out the U.K.-U.S. relationship was centuries in the making.
The United States and the United Kingdom have a long history. We were a colony of Great Britain. But really, when you think about it, World War I and then World War II cemented a relationship between the two English-speaking peoples that was strong militarily, that was strong politically. And as a result, no matter what Britain may have decided yesterday, it is important, it's in America's interest to have a strong relationship with the United Kingdom and a United Kingdom that remains committed to the transatlantic relationship and to Europe.
So how could Brexit change things between the UK and the US?
It doesn't need to change all that much. Our policy towards Europe is not dictated by the institutional arrangements. Our policy is dictated by our interest in having a strong, capable Europe that is united and able to act in concert with us to deal with the threats that we face.
Just at the practical level, like when the U.S. in the future makes any kind of deal with the EU, it'll also have to do deals with the U.K.? I mean, you're going to have to do two things instead of one thing?
Yes, certainly that's true on issues like trade. So we would negotiate a trade agreement, which we are negotiating right now with the European Union, and we would have to have a separate agreement with Great Britain. We have separate agreements with lots of countries. So it complicates things, but the challenge for statecraft is to take the cards that you're dealt and make the best deal out of it, rather than saying, let's go out now and punish the British for having made this decision. We're much better off defining ways to adapt ourselves to a strong relationship with the United Kingdom, with Europe, focused on maintaining a solidarity and unity to deal with the challenges that we face, both internally in Europe and externally from countries like Russia and indeed what's happening in the Middle East and North Africa.
Right. Well, as you say, the U.S. has agreements, trade and otherwise, with all sorts of countries, so it doesn't sound too onerous in that respect. But, I mean, you suggested things might be a little more complex with NATO. I mean, how is this going to affect the U.K., the U.S., and our involvement in NATO?
Well, formally, it shouldn't change anything. But informally, of course, the United Kingdom has suffered a blow. David Cameron has said he will resign, will not just be a lame duck, but he will be a defeated lame duck when he arrives in Warsaw for the NATO summit on July 8th. So the voice of Britain, which is used to be strong and important alongside the United States in NATO, that voice will be a little weaker. It's a challenge, but there are other European countries that are members of NATO and not the European Union, Norway, and they play vital roles in the alliance. And I see no reason to believe that the UK won't in the future as well.
Obama's going to be at that NATO summit in Warsaw next month. What do you suppose the leaders are going to be saying about Brexit?
They will not say much about Brexit, certainly not publicly. Privately, of course, they will discuss it. But I think what they will need to do, and I assume will do, is to reaffirm the importance of the relationship between the United States, Canada, and its European friends, including the United Kingdom. And the United Kingdom, I think, will be reinforced in making sure that everyone understands its commitment to NATO. There was nothing in the Leave vote on the European Union to suggest that there isn't any interest in the UK of weakening its commitment to NATO.
Ivo Dalder was President Obama's ambassador to NATO from 2009 until 2013. He's now the president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Ivo Dalder, thank you.
My pleasure.
Finally today, the presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump had this to say in a tweet about the Brexit vote. "Just arrived in Scotland. Place is going wild over the vote. They took their country back, just like we will take America back. No games." Well, he was a little off on that. While Britain as a whole voted to leave the EU, Scotland overwhelmingly chose to stay. It's not surprising Trump would praise a Brexit vote. John Cassidy of The New Yorker says you can hear echoes of the Leave campaign in Trump's stump speeches.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, it's some of the same language. In fact, Nigel Farage, the leader of the UK Independence Party, who was one of the leaders of the Leave campaign, talked about putting the great back into Great Britain. So that's actually, you know, the same word which Trump uses.
Aside from immigration, there was also a sense that globalization, both with the Trump campaign and with Brexit, has not been fair to a lot of people, right?
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things you have to think about when you talk about the rise of racism and nativism is what's driving it on an underlying level. Healthy democracies where people have rising living standards don't tend to fall for that sort of political ideology. There's obviously some people who are attracted to it, but it's usually a minority, a pretty small minority. What tends to convert extreme right-wing populisms into mass movements are economic problems or wars or some sort of cataclysm. And obviously, if you say the UK, what's been the big cataclysm? There hasn't been one thing, although obviously it was a big financial recession over 7 or 8 years ago. But just as in the US, the living standards of working people have been under sort of steady assault from globalization, automation, and influx of immigrants, some of them would argue. And that's just provided a sort of backdrop of resentment and increasing economic anxiety, which clever politicians like Nigel Farage have exploited to their own advantage and sort of diverted these anxieties into anti-immigrant rhetoric.
And yet I wonder if we're putting too much into the Trump campaign Brexit victory comparison, because a lot of the popularity behind the Leave vote was powered by this notion that Britain is simply better than Europe, right?
No, that's certainly true. I don't think you can just say because the Leave campaign scored a shock victory, Donald Trump's going to score a shock victory in November. The great advantage the Leave campaign had was that they had a very definable sort of enemy in Brussels, which the Brussels bureaucracy has been unpopular in Britain for a long time. And they could sort of make a positive argument that we can sort of revive Britain by breaking free of the shackles of the EU. I don't personally think that's a strong argument, but a lot of people in Britain believed it. And the Remain forces were left with a negative argument, basically saying we can't afford to leave the EU because it will ruin the economy. And they didn't really offer a positive vision of Britain's future within the EU. And I think that gave a big advantage to the Leave side.
John, are you disappointed in your home country?
Yeah, I've always been a supporter of the EU. I mean, I think one of the disappointing things is people sort of take the EU for granted and they don't realize what a great success it's been in historical terms. you know, this was a continent which for hundreds of years tore itself apart in wars. And then we had obviously the cataclysmic First World War and Second World War. The EU was basically an effort to rebuild Europe, starting out economically, but underlying the vision was always of a sort of peaceful, not federalized, but some sort of community of Europe, the details of which were always pretty vague. But I think it was an uplifting vision, a liberal vision, and a vision which, you know, still carries some force. But the British people, for now at least, have rejected it.
The New Yorker's John Cassidy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eric Goldberg composed our theme music from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. See y'all next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.